Thank you for downloading the Sparkwood and 21 podcast. We are covering the television series Twin Peaks. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. Spoiler warning, we are not a spoiler-free podcast. We do spoil things. So if you have not watched the show, please stop, watch the entire series, and then come back and listen to us. We'd love to have you listen, but we don't want to ruin anything for you.
If you want to support this podcast, the best thing you can do is head over to iTunes and write us a review. If you're uncomfortable with speaking your mind about us, you can also click on some stars. Also, you can go to our website at noship.net, click on the contact page, and you can write us some feedback. That pretty much is where most of the speculation happens. I think it's the most fun part of this podcast, and it'd be great to have more people involved and contributing their ideas. No matter how far-fetched, it's welcomed here.
Some of our ideas are pretty far-fetched, so it's welcome. Yeah, you're right. We also have an Amazon link. Just go to our homepage and click on the Amazon link. It'll take you to the Amazon homepage, and then you can do your shopping like normal. It doesn't cost you anything extra, but it helps us out a little bit. We get a little bit of kickback from Amazon, so it's a nice way to help us out without actually shelling out any money.
And with that, do you have your PSA?
Yes, for the remainder of the podcast, please stay on the bike.
All right, so before we get into recap, is there anything you want to say about this episode?
There's a lot that I want to say about this episode, but I'm a nice person, so I'm not going to say any of it.
No. Not that bad.
No, it's not. It's really not. It's definitely got some low points, and it starts some of my it starts in earnest some of my less than favorite subplots in Twin Peaks, and or at least one that I can think of, the Nadine storyline. Mm-hmm. When she has superpowers. I mean, we've already seen them before, but now they're starting to come out, and it's just kind of like, So I've heard the term jumping the shark bandied about a lot about this episode from things online and from some of our listeners who've corresponded with us on Gmail, and I have to agree. It is that point where this has happened. And it does get worse, and it does get better, so it's a mixed bag. I'll just say that.
All right, so let's go ahead and start talking about the episode. We are discussing Twin Peaks, Season 2, Dispute Between Brothers, which is written by Trisha Brock and directed by Tina Rathborn. Do you want to discuss the name of the episode at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's a badly named episode because the actual dispute between brothers, I would have to assume, is between the mayor and the owner of the newspaper.
Dwayne and Dougie.
Yeah, Dwayne and Dougie, but that is such a small part of this episode that I don't really. And then I could maybe see that there's another way you could look at it as Cooper and Roger are brothers
right.
in service, and there's a dispute between them. But really, he's just doing his job, just like Cooper did his job. So mm-hmm. The corrupt Mountie is a whole nother story. But other than that, I can't really think of anything else that would make the title fit.
But when they were naming these episodes, this one was just so out there. They didn't want to name it Jumping the Shark, so they had to name it something, and they just picked something random from the first couple of scenes.
They could, I mean, but just off the top of my head, if you just had to have a name to make it fit with everything that was going on, I mean, you could have just called it In the Wake or The Wake or something to do with yeah. The Wake, because that's the centerpiece of this episode, I think.
At the beginning.
I mean, it has the most characters in it, and it has, I mean,
it seems like they move on really quickly after that wake.
Okay, maybe centerpiece is the wrong term, but they spent the most time and effort. There's the most characters in that scene. They've got all that food that's
yeah.
coming out. I don't know.
All right, let's go ahead and get into
it. All right, let's do it.
Okay, it is 3 days later. At the Palmer household, Dr. Hayward offers a sedative to Sarah. She does not want it because she wants to be present for both Laura and Leland. Agent Cooper is there with him, and he tells Sarah that Leland did not do these things, not the Leland she knew. Sarah recalls Bob. Cooper says he is gone, forever. Cooper talks of how Leland drugged Sarah prior to the murders and what Leland's last moments were like before his death. This comforts her. Sarah is missing an earring, and she says Leland always found the missing earring. And I bring that up because I think that's how sad death is for the people who are left behind and how their lives change just so drastically. And just having that little illustration
reminder
of that yeah. where she's missing an earring. But I also want to point out, once again, Maddie is forgotten. There's no mention of Maddie, a beloved niece of hers, and she's not including her in the grief that she has, the person she also wants to be present for, and it's weird.
It is. It is. It's sad, really. I
I
mean,
know.
this. Nobody cares about Maddie, except James, who probably cares a little bit too much. But really, James just cares about himself anyway, so I don't know. It kind of reminds me of a part from that book that you just bought recently, Kim Gordon's memoirs,
Yeah.
Girl in a Band, and she's talking about the divorce from Thurston Moore. But anyway, she's just talking about divorces in general, and she's mentioning that when you get a divorce, it changes your life to the point where there's, I think she says something to the effect of, there's a million different little things in your everyday life that you didn't notice before, but now you notice them. So, Leland was always around to be able to find that other earring, and now he's not. So something that just would have been a matter of course 2 weeks ago or a day ago or 4 days ago in this case is now this big deal because it just keeps reminding you of that person. So what did you think of Cooper telling her that this was not Leland? Do we take this as a reinforcement of what happened at the end of the last episode, the way that Frost, Peyton, and the other writer,
Angles.
Engels, wanted to portray the whole Bob and Leland relationship?
Well, I mean, it corroborates the idea that the television show has been putting forth that it's a duality. You have Leland, the host, who is unaware of what's happening, and then you have Bob, who is the main driver of everything that
Well,
happened.
the reason I asked is because I didn't know if we were supposed to take Cooper's explanation of that as exactly how he felt about the situation, or if he's just trying to be a stand-up guy and just be like, okay, look, this lady lost her daughter a month ago, and now she just lost her husband, who actually ended up killing her daughter and her niece.
He
So,
believes it. I mean, at the end of last episode, he was wondering where Bob could be now.
yeah. Okay.
So the town of Twin Peaks has gathered for Leland's wake for a potluck feast. Nadine is dressed like a little girl. She's dressed younger than the age she thinks she is, I would like to point out.
Yeah, that's kind of odd.
She shines her patent Mary Janes and sees a distorted reflection of herself, which is metaphorical. It's appropriate.
I mean, she could look into any mirror at this point and
You
see a
see a
distorted.
distorted. Yeah. Hank is being ridiculously, overtly thoughful. And he's, you ever worked with people who don't really do a whole lot, but when they actually do something, they like announce it as they do it. Like, look, I'm taking out the trash. I'm taking out the trash.
I have, and
He's
it's very annoying. It's very annoying.
doing this with this.
I'm a thoughtless, cruel bastard most of the time, probably 98% of my whole life, but right now I'm doing something. What I noticed about this was that he got two full plates, and he brings one over to Sarah, and he says, "Here you go, eat it while it's hot." And then he keeps the other one while his wife is standing right there, and he doesn't offer her a plate. It's just kind of like, we're, you're making this play at being chivalrous, and you're just skipping the whole point.
And she gives or and he gives her an enormous plate of food, like piled high. Like, if you're most people who've had emotional issues, I think don't even want to eat anything.
That's how I feel. When I get super stressed out or I have like really strong emotions about something, I can't eat at all. Like that whole thing just turns off. I mean, I'll go the better part of a day without putting any food in my mouth. So it's really strange when I hear about people who binge eat because they have emotional problems. It's like that, it makes me want to do the opposite. But,
Yeah, I'm the opposite too. I'm trying to like get into his head though. Maybe it was a genuine gesture, and when he was putting her plate together, he just wanted to make her the most badass plate ever, and he put every single little thing he could find on it. I don't know.
having Hank Jennings in this scene at all was a weird choice,
Yeah.
but having him do that on top of it was just weird on top of weird.
So Audrey and Mrs. Hayward sit with Sarah. It seems like they don't really know what to do with Audrey, so they just plop her on the couch with them. But maybe it's because Audrey's growing up, and maybe it's supposed to show that she's.
Part of the women's group now rather than part of the children's group.
Yeah, because she doesn't have that coyness anymore. It's like it's as her hair's gotten a little bit longer, that part of her's lessened, it seems.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right.
Donna talks to Ed about James. James is still MIA, apparently. Dr. Jacoby is back from Hawaii, and he looks like he lost some weight. I'm not sure if it could be his clothing. Major Briggs welcomes Dr. Jacoby back to Twin Peaks. Cooper talks about taking a vacation. Major Briggs invites Cooper for some night fishing. Nadine worries about her underwear reflecting in her shoes, and she tells this to both Ed and Donna.
She's worried about the boys looking up her skirt.
Sarah talks of memories of Laura and Donna. Two elderly brothers get into a fight. Harry and Ed break it up. Pete explains the men are the mayor, Dwayne, and his brother, Dougie, who owns the newspaper. Dougie is engaged to a teenage babe, apparently, and this is upsetting Dwayne. Cooper says he is going to miss this town.
This is one of the storylines that I don't particularly care for that starts in this episode, this and the Nadine one. I don't think I'm alone in this. I think some of our listeners have written in and mentioned it as well, that there's the genesis of some kind of bad storytelling going on here. And I'm trying to stay positive. You know, I'm trying to look at all the points. And the scenes with Cooper in this episode are really good, I think. I especially like the camping scene with him and Major Briggs later on, or actually at the very end. So there is positive stuff to be talked about, people. We're not just going to down on it the whole time. I'm saying that to let you know.
It was funny watching Dougie like try to get a couple more smacks in, and Dwayne's just sitting there like winding up his fist lackadaisically, like he's gonna might punch him, you know. But anyway, so Ed and Dr. Jacoby drop Nadine off at school. Very short scene.
This, there's not much to talk about in this scene, but the principal is basically saying, hey, why am I going to let a 35-year-old come back here and pretend to be a student? They've already graduated. They've already done this. And ostensibly, Jacoby is there to explain to her Nadine's psychological state.
To him.
To him. Sorry. And what I thought was interesting about this is that later on in the episode, you've got Bobby Briggs asking Audrey asking him, I forget which, aren't you supposed to be in school?
Mm-hmm.
James, as when James and when Donna and Big Ed talk about James, and he says, oh, he, you know, he kind of went off, but he'll be back. So none of these kids are in school. The only character that we have that we know of that's actually in school that we actually get a backstory on, who's not a cardboard extra, is a 35-year-old. I mean, what the fuck? All the actual kids who are supposed to be in school are doing everything but maybe there's a little bit of irony in the fact that
maybe
the only one of the characters who is actually attending school is 35, and the four or five other characters that we have are just, they never appear in school again.
Yeah, you think that principal would be excited that somebody wanted to go.
Exactly.
Cooper packs his bags. Audrey pays him a visit. She wants to know when he's leaving. She thinks that he must have been hurt very badly from a previous relationship, and he tells her that he actually hurt someone, and he tells her about how this woman died in his arms and about Wenda Merle. Audrey tells him when she is grown up, she will be coming for him, and accuses him of being too perfect.
Fair warning. She's letting him know, you know, in a few months from now when I graduate high school, it's on.
Game on.
It's gonna happen. Just like a mental image in my mind of him just giving her the thumbs up. You know, like the Giants avatar, like, all right, aces.
She's like, game on. And Cooper's like, move out of the way, psycho hose beast.
I know I've been acting so crazy, Wayne. I'm pregnant.
Bobby tries on one of Leo's suits. Shelley is less than enthused. She needs to get out of the house, she says. Bobby tells her that when he lands his job with Ben Horn, it's going to be easy street.
And he's going to take care of her in ways that she's never imagined. What the hell does that mean?
She looks excited.
Yeah. She kind of gets a jive in there, though, because he's trying on the suit, and he's like, it's a little big. She goes, yeah, it fits. Leo fills it out a little better. Mm-hmm. It's like, ooh, snap. Because Leo is a man, and though even though he beat her, he actually took care of her at the same time.
Yeah, she looks super exhausted.
Not that I'm advocating domestic abuse just because the abuser pays the bills. I want that to be clear. But... at this, you know, I don't want anybody to misconstrue what I was just trying to say, but Bobby's talked a lot of talk, but he's not walking any walk.
So Catherine meets with Harry in his office. Catherine says she believes that an angel saved her life. She talks about the events around the mill fire and how she found herself in the woods. She was afraid at first and then flooded with childhood memories. She came across her old summer cabin. She believes only a guardian angel could have brought her there. She came back to Twin Peaks when she ran out of tuna fish.
So I kind of have a problem with this scene because there's two people who know that Catherine didn't die in the fire and that she's been scheming the whole time, that being Pete and that being Ben Horn.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Horn's not going to say anything because he's going to have to he's on the bad side of everyone right now because of what's happened. And he would have to convince everybody that Catherine was actually Tajimura the whole time. No one's going to buy it. It's crazy, even for Twin Peaks world. But Pete is going to have some sort of impetus to keep quiet about this. And he's usually pretty straightforward with Harry. So I don't know. I don't remember going forward how they handle this, but there's a potential there for Pete to kind of have to tell some white lies, I think.
Possibly. I think he's more loyal to Catherine than Harry. Dick Tremaine visits Lucy. He wants to give fatherhood a try, but he should start by worrying about the safety of the expectant mother. Andy interrupts him and says that they should be civil while Lucy is pregnant. Lucy likes this move from Andy, but still, neither of them offer to put those fluorescent bulbs in themselves.
That's definitely intentional. She's on a ladder putting up fluorescent bulbs, two very dangerous things when you get right down to it. Combine them together and you've got a pregnant woman doing it. No bueno. And neither of them are, you know, they're...
And Andy's talking about being civil as a way to create an environment that's good for the mother and child.
Healthy,
and yet she's
yeah.
up there teetering on top of this ladder.
But she does go for Andy's approach, though, because she's all leaning in for the kiss and he doesn't even realize it.
Hawk questions Andy's strategy. Cooper tells Harry goodbye. Harry gives him a special lure and a Bookhouse Boys badge. Cooper bids farewell to Hawk, Andy, and Lucy. A Mountie escorts a special agent, Roger Hardy, into the sheriff's department. Hardy tells Cooper he is suspended from the FBI. And when he says it in a very Yoda, almost Yoda-like way.
Yeah, it's his phrasing.
Yeah.
You know, he's putting, because Yoda has that way of talking where he puts things in front that should go in the back kind of deal.
He rearranges his clauses.
That's probably the best way to describe it. Yeah, I'm kind of getting lost in my own words here. Things that should go in the front, go in the back, that just sounds bad. But yeah, he does that. The scene with Harry and the Bookhouse Boys patch, first of all, I want one of those patches really bad. I would put that on my Twin Peaks shirt.
Okay,
that
I'll
get
one for you for your birthday.
No one can see us, I understand, but like I wear a Twin Peaks shirt every time we podcast. It's it's Laura Palmer as her doppelganger screaming. It's actually pretty creepy.
Mm-hmm.
But I would put the Bookhouse Boys patch on one of my sleeves just to... But anyway, the scene kind of got me choked up a little bit because those guys have a pretty good bromance going on through this. And, you know, they were good friends and they had a healthy respect for each other. And I think Harry viewed him as like he said multiple times, he's the best lawman I've ever seen. And I think Cooper was taken with the way Twin Peaks does business. And I think he used Harry as the prime example of that, you know, just a straightforward sheriff who... You know, he's always going to deal you right. And, you know, they built a friendship off of that. And I think it's nice.
And it just shows that the shine hasn't worn off for Twin Peaks as far as Cooper's concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's given that lure. He's super excited about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like Snowshoe Rabbit.
Yeah.
You know, he has that kind of childlike
exuberance
about it. And to me, that's what makes these episodes worthwhile watching is those little bits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you forget they're there because you just remember this part of season two as being so bad. But then when you actually sit down and watch it, it's rewarding in that sense.
So Roger, the special agent Roger Hardy, explains that he is in internal affairs. Cooper is being accused of misfeasance, as well as there being disturbing allegations about Cooper's motives and methods when he rescued Audrey.
I wonder, is misfeasance actually a word? Because I understand what malfeasance is, but misfeasance, I guess it would fit because it's doing something that you should be doing, but doing it illegally.
How did he describe misfeasance?
Just paraphrasing, he says doing something illegal in the process of doing something that would normally be legal. So it's not a bad thing or an illegal thing to save a kidnapped girl, but when you go across a national border and you end up killing somebody, even in self-defense, it makes it bad.
Okay. Bobby's plan gets off to a poor start. Ben won't even see him. Audrey encounters Bobby and asks what he is doing there. She gives him a helping hand. His meeting with the disheveled Ben does not last long. Two bodyguards drag Bobby out of Ben's office. Audrey rescues him from the guards. Bobby wants to reward her for saving his bacon. So she says she wants ice cream because she likes to lick.
This scene falls flat for me because I feel like they're trying to create a little bit of sexual tension between Bobby and Audrey. Not working at all. Not even barely. Not even the spark to light anything. And you know, there's more sexual tension between her and Cooper, and Cooper is just pretty steadfast in the fact that he doesn't want to be with her. But here, there's just it's like a wet blanket over the whole thing.
It would have been a nicer touch, the basket that she handed him, if that had her, like, her unmentionables that she just hand washed, you know, were in there. That would have been cool. But I guess she's doing what she said. She's doing stuff around the hotel to work her way up in her dad's.
Yeah, she's finally getting around to that now that she's recovered from, you know, kidnapping, and she's been weaned off heroin with methadone, I assume, and you know, everything else. They never touch
I
upon
should
that
laugh at
again.
that.
They don't ever touch upon that again. You know, wouldn't she need to come down? I think we
I
might have
don't
talked
know.
about it. Yeah.
I have no idea. I don't know how that works. I already said we see disheveled Ben, so this is also starting a subplot that's gonna grow where he's going down a lost path into Civil War
Yeah,
reenactments
it
and
starts out small. It's kind of like the itching in the back of your throat before you get a cold. You know, that we see one little tiny scene, maybe for 2 seconds. He's in a bathrobe smoking a cigar. He's not dressed in his sharp suits. He's not standing upright and straight and giving his witty repartee. He's just kind of like he is, like you said it, disheveled.
throat itch is a good way to describe him.
Just in general, Ben Horn's like a throat itch.
Cooper's interrogation is in progress. It intentionally calls back when Cooper was on the other side of the table interrogating some of the townspeople of Twin Peaks, because he's sitting where Bobby was sitting, and there's the videotape with his image frozen on there when they had Laura's frozen before. You could say that this is pointing to Cooper being now a full-fledged member of Twin Peaks, I think.
That's a good point. I agree with that.
They question him about his visits to One-Eyed Jack's and the deaths of Jacques and Blackie. The Mountie claims to have been working on a sting operation against Jean Reno, and Cooper's shenanigans messed it all up. See, he's got shenanigans now. He's totally a Twin Peaks citizen. So, and apparently there's drugs missing from the scene, and they're trying to pin that on Cooper. And Cooper admits to the border crossing, but denies any involvement with the drug transaction. Cooper is asked to surrender his gun and his badge.
This Mountie, obviously, as we see in a later scene, is in the employ of Jacques Renault. Jean Renault. And he's way out of his league with this. You can't try to frame somebody like Cooper. It's not going to happen. If he didn't do it, it's going to come out somehow because he is a damn fine lawman. There's just no way around it.
So on that note, Truman is called in and he gives Cooper the bookhouse boy salute before Cooper exits the room. Harry is not cooperative with Roger Hardy. Harry says that Cooper is the finest lawman he has ever known. Whatever info they have against Cooper is dead wrong.
As far as Harry's concerned, he's a native now. He's one of them, and he's going to protect him by all means necessary. He'd do the same thing for Hawk and probably for Handy.
Yeah, for Andy. So Nadine tries out for the cheerleading squad. She throws a male cheerleader up into the air, like 35 feet or so. I don't know. It was really high.
Like if you were honestly thrown that high in the air and you landed, regardless of how you landed, you'd break something. There's not a whole lot to say about this scene, so let's just move on.
So Shelley brushes Leo's teeth and the phone rings. It is Bobby. He tells her that the meeting went well, and he asks her if she still loves him. She tells him that she does love him, and she wants to put Leo in a home. Then Leo moves his wheelchair, and she notices this toward the end of the phone conversation.
You know, she's perturbed because she's brushing his teeth, and then the phone rings. She says, "Oh, all day and not a word from you." And now the phone rings, and I think she said something to the effect that that must have been the longest job interview ever. So I wonder, has Bobby just been hobnobbing with Audrey this whole time, or?
See, it would have been interesting if, you know, there is a bit of Leo that is conscious and maybe he's actually falling in love with her, you know, as she takes care of him. Because I thought it was actually a kind of a touching, intimate scene, her brushing his teeth like that. You know, she's super exhausted, but from Leo's point of view.
Yeah, that would be really cool. That'd be an awesome twist if that's how it was. I mean, I guess I don't know if we'll ever know because we don't know what threads are going to get picked back up on in 2016, but that's a pretty romantic way to look at it.
He's a changed man.
He does change and he does care about her. So, because, you know, we see later with the scenes of Wyndham Earle and
Yeah, he says Shelley.
he tells.
He's like a that movie BC with Ringo Starr. Zug, zug. Anyway.
I must have been 8 years old the last time I saw that.
Norma removes the decorations from the diner as she tells her mother about the review. Vivian reveals that she is M.T. Wentz. Norma gets upset, as she should. Her mother tells her to be sensible, and Norma tells her to get out.
This is actually some good writing and some good acting. Not necessarily on Norma's part, not that she did a bad job, but the mother did a really good job, because everybody knows a person in their life that's like that. Hopefully it's not your mother. But
hopefully it's not you.
And hopefully it's not you. Yeah. What do they say? Everybody knows a certain type of person in your life, and if you don't know them, you are it. Yeah. But everybody does know somebody like that, and they have this way of just saying stuff to you that just tears you down. And then when you have a genuine reaction to that, a real emotional reaction to that, they act like it's your fault. They put mm-hmm. it back on you, and they're just like, well, you're just deciding to take it that way. You know what I mean? I'm not really saying, you know, you could take it any way you want to, and you're just taking it hard. I'm just trying to help you, you know, like by saying that your food is shit, that's somehow constructive criticism, you know? And so overall, does this scene really have much to do with what I really love about Twin Peaks? Absolutely not. But it's a well-acted scene and a well-written scene.
Poor Norma.
I know. I like Norma, and I just feel like,
it's like the people that are in her life that are allowed to be around her, you know, that she can legitimately interact with are all assholes, except for Shelley.
But
Shelley's not even working there
anymore.
She's
extricated herself from the situation, you know, so she doesn't even have that friend to rely on.
So Hank and Ernie are at One-Eyed Jack's, apparently having a good time. Hank is, anyway. Ernie is there against his will. We know that Hank has blackmailed him. Jean Reno walks in, and Hank introduces Ernie as the professor. John says they need $125,000 immediately. Ernie says that won't be a problem. He says he is hardwired and he is John's man. John introduces the same Mountie that was accusing Cooper of messing with his sting operation to both Hank and Ernie. Then they send a reluctant Ernie with Hank to the gambling tables. The Mountie doesn't trust Ernie, says he's too nervous, and he then takes some cocaine from their stash to use to frame Cooper with.
So, I really don't know what to say about this scene.
I know.
Mean, it's one of those things to where, I mean, we all know how it plays out. We all know that Cooper is found not to be guilty of this, and, you know, John ends up dead, and spoiler alert. As far as this scene is concerned, when you realize that that's the same Mountie who is sitting with the internal affairs agent, you're just like, okay, some shenanigans are going on here, and they're going to take the coke and they're going to try to frame Cooper and everything else. And here's another subplot that is just only loosely related with, you know, what we know and love about Twin Peaks. And it's not one of the shittier ones, but it's definitely not one of the better ones. The further Twin Peaks gets away from the lodge, Laura, and some sort of nefarious doings like that in that realm. I wish there was another L so I could say the three L's of Twin Peaks, but maybe it's just the two L's, the Lodge and Laura, because everything's, you know, has Leland. The duality. There you go. The Lodge, Laura, and Leland. We'll add a third one in there. The further it gets away from that, the less interesting it becomes for the people who really loved it during the first season. But
Leo.
Well, I guess there's a lot of L's. What am I talking about?
All right. Harry sleeps, and he snores, if you believe closed captioning. Josie breaks in, and he showers her with kisses.
Yay, Josie's back. Hooray.
So she's back. I guess there'll be more on that later, so we don't really need to talk too much about that. But he's definitely not worried about asking her any questions about her assistant.
Why? Yeah, no questions about her assistant. No questions about where you've been. No questions about why you look like you've got beat up and you've been sleeping in the mud. It's basically just kind of like, oh, I'm going to start kissing you right now.
Not even like, are you okay?
Yeah.
You're crying.
Why are you here? Why wouldn't you go back to...
You broke in like you were just stumbling out in the woods, like sobbing your eyes out. Like, I don't know. It's kind of weird.
Yeah. I mean, why wouldn't you go back to your own house if you just got back from Hong Kong or wherever you went and take a shower, take a bath, to have, you know, sleep, and then call me in the morning?
Somebody hunting you? Okay. Cooper talks with Major Briggs about the idea of Bob's existence. They're out on their fishing trip.
Mm-hmm.
Briggs talks about resisting darkness and asks if Cooper has heard of the White Lodge. Something seems to move towards them in the woods. Cooper excuses himself to take a pee. Owls are present. Suddenly, a white light and a hooded form silhouetted against the brightness. Major Briggs is nowhere to be found. End of episode.
This one kind of just leaves me like, you know, Cooper comes back and he's gone and there's a hooded figure there. I have no idea who that's supposed to be. Because all those lights and everything, it's the TV and movie version of saying aliens are coming to abduct somebody right now. That's how they do it.
It's a Wiccan.
It's a Wiccan.
It's a Wiccan out in the woods.
Close encounters of the Wiccan kind.
Yep. Which I've actually seen out in the woods before. Myself and my ex-boyfriend and a friend of ours, we used to go walk around in these woods in California where I lived in Sonoma. And all of a sudden we were just walking around. All of a sudden this like line of a couple of people walk by real quickly and they're all wearing hoods and had like canes and shit. We're like, whoa. It was like really quick.
I thought you were going to say that.
I don't know
like...
if we scared them. I know they scared us, but they moved so fast like they were scared.
They probably just didn't want to be bothered, you know? They're probably just like, I always have this secret thought that people who are doing Wiccan stuff don't want anybody to watch them because then they'll be embarrassed.
Probably. It just depends. I think it was Windermere. I think maybe he witnessed it. Maybe it was a coincidence. Or it's an alien involved, or it could be all the like aspects. It could be a man from another place, and Mike, and Bob, and the giant, and they're all like wearing a cape. They mesh themselves together like Voltron, and then they put a cape on, and that sort of figure.
That's probably the most plausible explanation I've ever heard for who that could be.
That's a great theory. I'm proud of it.
I like it. Let's keep it.
Okay.
Moving on to feedback.
All right, moving on to feedback and whiskey, because I've made a new rule that I can't drink until we get to feedback.
It's a good rule, people. It's a good rule. It may sound weird to you out there in podcast land, but trust me, it's a good rule. I'd just like to say that if you're listening to this and you feel like we've maybe given this episode short shrift, I just want to say that's not our intent. We're trying to approach this from, obviously, like we've approached, if you've listened to us, you know, we're approaching it the same way that we've approached every episode, but our enthusiasm and our level of passion for any particular episode is going to be directly correlated with the quality of said episode. So once the quality of the writing starts to drop off a little bit, it kind of gives us, it doesn't kind of, it does give us a little bit less to work with. So we, you know, we try to kind of crimp it around the edges, so to speak, and find humor where we can and find the good moments where we can. And we will be negative where negativity is warranted. But I just want all of our listeners to understand that we're not doing this in any kind of mean spirit, and we're not trying to rush through these recaps because they're not the best episodes or whatever, you know, go like, well, why did Sparkwin and 21, why did they spend an hour and a half talking about, you know, season one, episode five, but then when we get to season two, episode 10 or 11, it's a, you know, they talk about it for less time than the episode was actually on. But really, we're just limited by what the creators and the writers give us at any given time.
Well, I mean, just some of the scenes just don't really inspire me to really delve into it as much, you know. I hate to say that I don't care, but there's a similar feeling to that.
It's not outright apathy, but you're right, it's like some of the scenes in Twin Peaks
I just would rather move on to the next thing, and maybe that will be more interesting, if that makes sense.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, some of the scenes in earlier Twin Peaks really beg for insightful discussions, and then you fast forward a little bit, and then you've got Nadine throwing somebody into the air 35 feet. So that's what we're up against, and that's what we're doing. But I mean, we are doing the whole series from pilot all the way to Fire Walk With Me, and then getting ready for 2016. So nothing's going to be left out, but there are definitely some peaks and valleys. So that's that.
Okay, so now we're going to get into feedback, and we're going to start with our letter from Joel. All right, Steve's going to read feedback today.
Okay, our first piece of feedback is from Joel, and he writes, despite the title of this email, I'm going to focus mostly on the previous episode, including your coverage. Great episode of the podcast. Thank you, Joel. lots of interesting observations and questions. Though the canted angle thing still doesn't quite jive for me aesthetically, I love your thematic interpretation. That, at least, makes it more like an intellectual, more on an intellectual level, and respect to Tim Hunter's decision. The odd thing is, as critical as I am of his work on this and the second to last episode, his season one entry, The One-Armed Man, is really, really underrated, and I think it's one of the most well-directed non-Lynch episodes. I also find the idea that this is where Cooper's possession begins intriguing. Carmen Cloutier, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, or Cloutier, who hosts the obnoxious and anonymous YouTube channel, has said that back in 1990, when this episode aired, he thought that's what was happening because Harry asks, "Where's Bob now?" And we immediately cut to a silent shot of Cooper. You mentioned that the writers might not have come up with this idea yet, and I think that's probably true. In Reflections, Harley Payton mentions approaching Mark Frost with this idea, and though he's unclear on the timeline, it sounds like he's talking about writing the last episode, so it may have been very last minute. But if so, they did a great job accidentally foreshadowing through the second season, as Cooper becomes more troubled and vulnerable to darkness. Check out something strange that happens in the next episode too, meaning the one you just covered before reading this feedback. When Cooper is saying goodbye to the sheriff's staff and the FBI/Mountie storm in to reprimand him, there is the Bob Wanted poster still there right behind his hand as his head whips up to hear the news. It replaces the poster in the shot. Coincidence? Cue ominous music and arched eyebrow. As for the later episode being called Return to the Black Lodge, though that's just a title added by Germans when the episode aired there later on, so more hindsight than foreshadowing. And I love Daniel's idea about Mike grooming Cooper to be his next host. To address a couple of questions you've thrown out there, I've heard that the significance of the water is that it's putting out the fire that is Bob. I believe that's what they were going for, if anything. Regarding the O under Maddie's fingernail rather than an E, great point. I think it's aesthetic on Lynch's part. An O just looks better as a signature of death, like a zero, the void. And it's a circle, like the ominous record player and ceiling fan. Ah, that's a good point.
Or the ring.
Yeah. The ring. Well, then he goes on to say the ring in Fire Walk With Me complicates this interpretation, but we'll get to that later. As for Leland's mysterious they, if I had to speculate, I would say that the writers didn't have any idea yet who they were, but wanted to establish multiple dark forces out there to keep their options open for the future. I hadn't thought of that, but that's a really good point. Keep the mystery alive, so to speak, which makes you wish they didn't completely drop the ball on the mythology for the middle of the season, but hey. That brings us to episode 17. To be brief, for all the flaws of the previous episode, this is clearly the one where the show jumps the shark. Amen, brother. At least for a while. Cooper basically dumps Audrey. Nadine throws a teenager in the air, complete with terrible effects and cheesy sound cues. The horrible mayor and his brother subplot begins. And worst of all, Leland's wake is played for sitcom laughs with everyone ignoring the fact of what just happened. On a show that begins by acknowledging how the community deals with grief, guilt, and loss, this may be the biggest misstep of all. Also notice Sarah's last line, "I want to remember everything." How ironic that this is literally the last time we will see her until the finale, and the only reason she's in that is because Lynch changed the screenplay to bring her back. Finally, Leland and Bob. I actually don't have too much to add to this point, though probably more will come up later on, maybe if other listeners chime in on the feedback. I agree that the Fire Walk With Me interpretation is better/more compelling for the reasons mentioned. I would also add that for a dramatic standpoint, it's much stronger to make Leland a partner rather than a puppet of Bob, although I don't think he knows Bob exists in Fire Walk With Me, but we'll get to that. As you have noticed in Season 2, figuring out when Bob is in complete control tends to marginalize Leland himself to the point where he barely exists as his own character. In the film especially, I think there may be only one scene when the good side of Leland is predominant. Seeing them intermingled makes him a far more rich and interesting figure, albeit also less likable. Lynch said Fire Walk With Me is, among other things, about the war inside Leland. This theme becomes the thought line in all of his later films, particularly Lost Highways and Mulholland Drive, but especially Lost Highways. Even if Mark Frost had a different read on the Bob and Leland relationship, his collaboration with Lynch on this subject seems to have pushed Lynch in a new direction. From Twin Peaks on, he explores duality in his characters, and especially how denial plays a big part in that. This is only hinted at in Blue Velvet, mostly buried in the battle between Frank and Jeffrey. All right, so to tackle some of the points, he says, I really like the idea of the O under Maddie's fingernail rather than the E being like a zero or a void and just symbolizing death. That's cool.
That's the, I believe the zero though on the tarot deck is the Fool's card,
You
I think. But that, I mean, that has nothing to do with anything.
never know.
I don't know what the death number is.
Okay, he says, for the later episode being called Return to the Black Lodge, though that's just a title added by Germans when the episodes l aired later on, so more hindsight than foreshadowing. Agreed.
Gesundheit.
Mein Gott. If anybody could write us in or direct us to some information that could give us clarity on this, did the Germans just get to arbitrarily name the episodes for whatever reason? Themselves, or did the writers and the creators get to do this? If anybody knows this for sure, if they could just let us know, that'd be awesome. So we have another touch on the whole Bob and Leland relationship, and I think we said a lot about this already, but it's worth just kind of talking a little bit more about it since Joel brings it up when he says he doesn't actually have too much to add to this point, though probably won't come up more later if other listeners chime in on the feedback. And he says, I agree that Fire Walk With Me's interpretation is better and more compelling for the reasons mentioned. And it's from a dramatic standpoint, it's stronger to make Leland apartment an apartment. It's stronger to make Leland a partner rather than a puppet of Bob. So that's my whole point. We don't have to reiterate or go back into it, but just I believe that the Fire Walk With Me interpretation of it is should be considered canon, quote unquote, and is far superior than Frost's version. I think Frost's version is a common denominator PG version of a
Yeah,
very
because it was on
complicated,
television.
very complicated process. But I mean, Twin Peaks was out there pushing the envelope the whole time, and they pulled back at this particular point for whatever reason. Maybe they thought it was just too much. I don't know. But there was a lot of things you saw in Twin Peaks that you had never seen on television before. And hindsight's always 20/20, but it maybe it would have been cool for David Lynch to just be like, I'm going to exert my influence on this here. But who knows? David Lynch may not have really solidified the idea of Bob and Leland's relationship being what it is in Fire Walk With Me till then. So.
Well, it's a good thing it's going to be on Showtime because they're going to have more freedom to present things in that way without, because they were on ABC before. I mean, you're not going to have the subject matter or the blurred lines, as Daniel put it, on an ABC show like you did in the movie Fire Walk With Me. That's just the way it is.
Okay, we got another letter from Joel, but we're going to pick and choose some parts of this to read that were kind of salient to the conversation we were already having, like about Lynch and Frost and Leland and Bob and everything. And he says, what's interesting is that when Lynch comes back to direct the final episode, according to the book Reflections, Harley Payton and Mark Frost came up with Cooper getting possessed by Bob. Martha Nachmanson, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly as well, strongly believes that Lynch did not really like this direction, although he was stuck with it as a season finale. For whatever reason, Lynch does not seem to have been interested in participating in the writing process of Twin Peaks, though he's often written the screenplays to his own films. But he radically changes the Black Lodge sequence. Not sure if you've read the screenplay before, but it makes a fascinating contrast. And he gives us a link to, if you want to put this link up to,
To share,
yeah, to
yeah, and I'd
share.
like to read it myself because I know that they had written the season finale, and I had read that also in Reflections, and then he came, I think it was Harley Payton had, and then David Lynch came in and just like threw it all out and was like, nope, we're doing this. So I've always wondered what that other screenplay was.
He goes on to say, on the most obvious level, Lynch reduces Windham Earl's presence to a minimum, creating a much more abstract, nearly wordless sequence in place of the monologues that were written. More fundamentally, he ties the lodge in with the mythology and mystery of the first half of the series by bringing in the little man, the giant, Leland, Maddie, and the room service waiter. Only Laura and Bob were scripted in different fashion than they were used. Maybe most importantly, though, he adds the idea of Cooper splitting in two and being overcome by his shadow. Remarkably, given that the seeds were planted with Hawk's speech in episode 18, this wasn't actually in the teleplay. Instead, Bob just takes Cooper's soul, or is about to when Laura confronts him. The outcome is left to our imagination until Coop sees Bob in the mirror. Coop does see a double of himself, but nothing comes of it, and it's way before the climax of the lodge sequence. Having his doppelganger be the ultimate challenge, which Cooper fails, does a few things. It keeps alive the idea of a good Dale, as Lynch reveals in Fire Walk With Me, but it also was important for Lynch to show that Cooper was up against himself, as he says in Lynch on Lynch. Funny thing being, this actually fulfills Frost's idea of Cooper better than Frost's original script. That's one reason I really value Frost's contribution. Although I don't love the way Cooper's backstory is handled, I think giving Cooper a downward trajectory really does strengthen the show's narrative arc, desperately needed after the mystery is solved, and lays the groundwork for Lynch to knock the ball out of the park in the finale. Alongside the Leland-Bob dilemma and Laura's own duality, Cooper's fall from grace forms a sort of trilogy of examples that Lynch will draw from in later films as this sort of flawed protagonist becomes a staple in his work, in a way that it was not before he worked with Frost. As to Leland and Bob, I don't know. As noted above, Frost was very into conflicted characters, so you'd think he would like the ambiguity. However, he has also a more genre-based sensibility when it comes to treating the supernatural, or actually to narrative in general. In interviews, he is way more cerebral about and conscious of influences of his work than Lynch. It honestly seems like he wasn't exactly sure how to portray Leland, and maybe the other writers filled that vacuum by taking the most obvious route. After all, he co-wrote episode 16 with Peyton and Engels. Last summer, I found a really cheap book online from 1990 about the making of the series, probably not cheap anymore after the 2016 announcement. It offers a lot of fresh perspectives that have since been clouded by time. Here's Frost on Bob. It's kind of like the relationship between an artist and an agent. He is a creature from somewhere else, and maybe he's only from within Leland. We don't exactly say where he was belched up from. He is somebody who kind of went along for the ride. When Leland talks about knowing Bob as a child and says this was someone who invited me to play and I invited him in, there's a certain classic type of vampire myth that comes into play when a soul that invites something into it to take part in its life cannot then refuse it anything. There's a myth that goes back before pre-Christian times, and that's one possible explanation. The other is that Leland is just completely whacked out of his mind. So that's all I'm going to read from Joel's second letter, but what do you think of any of that? It's a lot to take in.
It is a lot to take in. It's very heady, too.
I don't like Frost's ambiguity on it. Because I know Lynch has a lot of ambiguity in his artistic vision, and he's, you know, a lot is left up to audience interpretation. But I feel like him saying something like, this is one possible explanation after he says that whole paragraph about the vampire and, right. You know, what it could possibly be. And then you have the ellipses. And then the other is that Leland is just completely whacked out of his mind. So is there a subtext to really bite into, or are we just looking at an observation of a crazy person?
I feel like that last statement, Leland being whacked out of his mind, is just a flippant comment he said. There's no way you can say that in seriousness. Bob is something that's been seen by other people as well.
Exactly.
And the whole story of Laura's death would be lessened because of it. I think it's just a flippant comment.
But I mean,
But outside of that, if that is a flippant comment, which I think it is, I don't think he's ambiguous at all, except for, you know, about giving us more about the mythology, like knowing where these people come from and who they are, you know, what they want. That's ambiguous. But as far as, like, to me, I think it's pretty cut and dried. Leland was possessed by Bob. I mean, I definitely feel like David Lynch is more ambiguous about it.
David Lynch is more ambiguous to me about, in my opinion, he's more ambiguous about the specific nature of their relationship. Is one in control at this point, or is the other in control at that point? Do they feed off of each other? Is it a parasite and host relationship? Is it a symbiosis? Whatever it is, but Lynch's vision of this requires a lot of darkness on Leland's part in the first place to make it work. And I guess what I was trying to say about so that can definitely be considered ambiguous. For sure. But what I was saying about Frost being ambiguous is maybe not ambiguous, but wishy-washy, because it's kind of like giving this whole tirade about how these things definitely happened, and this is the way they happened in the fashion that they happened in, and here you go, here it's all charted or not. You know, and so you're just kind of like left with this, I don't know. But it's definitely food for thought. I mean, we can...
He might have said it in a joking way. I just can't imagine him being serious about that last comment.
Yeah. But then he says the last paragraph I'm going to read from Joel's letter is he kind of addresses that thing too. He says, which sounds much more ambiguous/ambivalent than what most people, myself included, take from the actual episode. So again, not sure. My guess would maybe be his big priority was just end the Laura mystery before it kills the show and get us on track to emphasize Cooper as the central protagonist, so maybe he didn't really think too much about the complexities of Leland's situation. For him, he was probably more of a side issue, whereas Lynch increasingly and Laura's life, he and Laura's life were worth exploring in greater depth, he being Cooper.
If that's the case, that's too bad.
Well, it just shows you the difference between the artistic vision of the two because, you know, Frost wanted to get on writing about Cooper because, you know, Lynch is a movie guy. Frost is a TV guy. Mm-hmm. So I think Frost probably recognized, rightly so, that eventually we have to get over this Laura Palmer thing and we have to make a TV show about the people who live in this show that we fucking call Twin Peaks. So even though I don't necessarily tend to like Frost's vision so much as I do Lynch's, I kind of agree with it on a practical level, you know, as far as moving past that and getting towards it. I'm always going to be a David Lynch Fire Walk With Me guy as far as Leland and Bob is concerned, but with what Lynch was trying to do pragmatically for the survival of the show, I actually think that was a better idea.
Frost.
All right, so anything else to say about that?
Nope.
I'm going to read the next piece of feedback is from
Daniel.
Where is Daniel?
Daniel wrote to us on Facebook too. We could pull that up as well, but I know he let us know that there was a connection. Bob Engels wrote or was a co-writer on Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me along with that last episode, Arbitrary Law. I had actually mentioned that on the podcast, but I had edited off because I had edited off a lot of stuff on that podcast. It was a circular discussion, the smorgasbord, that was – the discussions just kept kind of going in circles.
Yeah.
So yeah. I tried to make it more linear, and some things got edited off, and that was one of them.
All right. Next up, we have a letter from Daniel, and he says, "Hey, Em and Steve, I remember the first time I watched the series years ago. I had no idea about the production details, so I just assumed the whole thing was a consistent vision of the same people throughout." I did too, but the subplots they chose to feature were baffling to me, but in my naivety, I assumed they were all connected to the central mystery, and there would be some big payoff in the end. It was frustrating. Like, when are they going to get onto the stuff I care about? But I think that there are a lot of enjoyable moments, beat by beat, which can be fun to just laugh at, make fun of, or wonder why they showed this or that. Said all that to say, I don't think there's a single episode that I can point to and say there was absolutely nothing I enjoyed in that one. The Wake is such a mess. Compared to Laura's funeral in episode 3, by the same director even, I can understand that Leland having molested his daughter was probably not made public knowledge, but there is no way that him being a serial killer and his own daughter's murderer wasn't ran by the Twin Peaks Gazette on the front page. I am completely baffled by the town's lack of reaction of any kind to finding this out about one of their most upstanding citizens. I want to see Donna react. James already left, but I want to see his reaction to finally understanding why Laura was so messed up, especially when there was that moment in the film where he pulled up to talk to Laura and Leland was warily watching him from the house steps and clearly giving him the creeps. Bobby should have some reaction too. He knew she was in trouble, and now he knows why. You could almost look at their behavior as more of the same kind of collective denial about the dark, rotten center of their town and repression of their own guilt for failing to stop this from happening in the first place. Yeah, agreed. Definitely agreed. When you look at this Wake and you look at the one for the funeral scene for Laura in season 3, I didn't realize they were the same director, but,
yeah, why isn't Doc Hayward like, man, I had so many family dinners with them and I had never like picked up any signs that anything was going on or,
yeah.
You know, they're sitting here joking about the mayor and his, newspaper man.
So
brother.
Yeah, exactly, which is just a completely inane, stupid subplot. And, you know, when going back to Joel's feedback, he's talking about how Frost was focused on getting past Laura and getting on with the writing of the TV show. That's only worthwhile if you've got a good TV show to write, you know? And there's great elements in Twin Peaks that still exist at this point, but the focus, the spotlight is not on them. We're worried about these two elderly men fighting about, you know, one of them marrying a 20-year-old or however old she is. I don't know. Pete says teenage. He's marrying a teenager and he's 104. He's exaggerating on both ends. I think she might have been 19. I don't know, but that's, you know, neither one
We'll
of those
find
things.
out because she's going to show up. But I wanted to say quickly about what he was saying, how he trusted that everything was going to carry through. Everything was going to make sense. What did Daniel say?
He said, the subplots they chose to feature were baffling to me, but in my naivety, I assumed they were all connected to the central mystery and there would be
Right.
some big payoff in the end. Before that, he said, I just assumed the whole thing was a consistent vision of the same people throughout.
Right. And I think I experience that even still today, even though I'm less naive. When you kind of get you so when you start watching a show, you have a level of wariness. You're not sure if the show is going to be any good. And then if it's really good, it sucks you in and you have this love for it, which I think equals trust. And then you start to trust that everything's going to be okay. And you
It's
know,
not always.
no, I mean, even in we're a show we love that we podcast on Vikings, it's still a really good season, but there's deleted scenes because for the American audience, and it there's something going on there. So it starts to make you feel a little you start to feel less trustful in a way when you start noticing holes. But
Especially being a podcaster, because you're trying to be entertaining and insightful about what's going on screen, but you don't have the whole picture to work with, you know, and you're just kind of, it's frustrating. But I had written Daniel back and I told him that I felt the same way exactly, you know, when you had introduced me to Twin Peaks. It was actually in 1999 and you had me watch Fire Walk With Me because that was the only thing that was available, you know. And then when I you know, when we were living in Boise and we got the box set and we just kind of devoured it and we watched it all the way through. And then when we were right about now, where we're getting to in season two, you start kind of scratching your head and going, yeah, you know, you don't think about it, like as you don't think about it as something that you're analyzing at the time and going, I thought all these people were executing a consistent artistic vision. You don't think about that. You just assume that's what's happening because that's how it's always been with TV shows, but not the case with Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks got bounced around like a four square ball. You know, I mean, once you get into the second season, it's different people directing, writing, and producing almost every time. The only consistency is the executive producers, which are Frost and Lynch, but their name just gets tacked up there. That's all that is. There's episodes that they didn't have anything to do with, you know? So, I mean, he goes on to say, what do you think is that shot of a rusty trap? Remember, we were talking about it.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
I can't make heads or tails of that. We kind of discussed it like in a 2 second conversation last night when we were watching the
I
episode
didn't realize
again.
you were asking me that because of feedback. I would have rewound it
Now, it
and.
wasn't because of feedback. It was just because I forgot that Daniel had written that. I just looked at it and it didn't hook up. It wasn't connected to the previous scene or the one, you know, coming right after. So I didn't know what to make of it. So I'm not really sure. So do you think Catherine's story about the angels has any truth to it? I think that the cabin she found must be where Andrew Packard has been hiding, and he helped her with the Taja Mora plan. Any opinion on that?
I think I've stated before that I think Andrew.
That's what, yeah, you have actually. I remember you saying that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
it's an assumption. I don't know, but
And you know, she makes herself, we didn't mention this in the cast proper, but she makes herself look like she's been living out there. She dirties up her cheek. It's kind of funny that Bobby isn't trying to blackmail Ben for a bunch of money. He just wants a job. Speaking of which, even if he was innocent of Laura and Maddie's murders, shouldn't Ben Horn still be on the hook for at least having sex with several minors operating an illegal brothel, both of which Audrey told Cooper about, not to mention questions still surrounding the mill fire conspiracy? Yes, that is a major, I mean.
well, Daniel himself has pointed out Harry's lack of
Well, Hawk is going to put two and two together at some point, right? And
yeah.
shouldn't Cooper, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it left up to Truman. I think a lot of things will get untaken care of in the, you know, law and order division of Twin Peaks. But, you know, with somebody like Cooper on the scene, I mean, it should come to, I don't know. But yeah, good point. You know, Ben Horn is on, he should still be on the hook for a lot of stuff. I mean, everything that Audrey told Cooper just kind of, I don't know if he planned on going back to Philadelphia and filling out a report
Well,
or what.
the fact that he owned is it One Eye Jack's is across the border, and the fact that he owned it across the border, does that provide him some level of protection since it wasn't on American soil.
That could possibly be a loophole. Yeah, that's a good point. But it's you know, they don't have DNA proof, but it's common knowledge now that he was having sex with Laura and she was underage, so there's
Yeah,
that.
there's that
But I mean, without the
statutory rape without, it's the
Yeah.
word of Audrey against his at
Exactly.
this point.
Yeah. So he goes on to say, it almost feels like the writers were briefly trying out an Audrey-Bobby relationship here, but it is so obvious how annoyed Sherilyn Fenn is with the whole thing and how half-heartedly she's delivering those lines, especially the I like to lick. You can see it on her face.
I actually felt it more in the scene between her and Cooper. I felt like there was something there where she was just kind of saying her lines, but
Really?
I felt like there was something else underneath. Like she was not, it was going against her grain. Like she doesn't like this scene. That's how I felt about it.
Huh, that's interesting because I didn't get that, but now next time I watch it, I'm probably going to see it, and I don't know if it's going to be because of force of suggestion or because if it's really there, or, you know, it's up to opinion anyway, but that's interesting.
I with what he's talking about her, I like to lick. I it always rubbed me the wrong way just because it doesn't like her way of flirting is like this it's different. I don't know, it just didn't seem like an Audrey way. It's a little bit too on the nose for her. She's more like she does those non sequiturs more
Right,
and
right.
do you like my ring and stuff like that and I don't know.
Well, we were talking about the other that movie the other day, just because it came up, because something about Sarah Michelle Gellar. What's it called? Cruel
Oh,
Intentions.
yeah.
Horrible, horrible movie. You know, and one of the things that you know it's coming. One of the things that I had said was how there's this big distance between what looks good on paper and what actually gets executed well in delivery. So, you know, you're reading the lines and you're saying Sarah Michelle Gellar is going to tell somebody to eat my pussy. That sounds like it would really go over like gangbusters. Then when you watch the movie, in your mind you conjure up all these scenes where she could be saying that and you're like, "Right on." And then I don't know if you've ever seen this movie, but watch it just for the scene just so you can see what we're talking about, or you know, YouTube this scene or whatever, and she says it, and you just cringe, and you're just like, "Oh my God, that this is
I think it's
horrible."
because
I
we
wish I
saw
was.
it as sh her as Buffy, and it was
Okay, point, but
that's
I
why.
mean, it probably did make it worse because of that, but it was still just bad in the first
Yeah.
place. So Audrey here too, we have a similar thing to where if somebody handed me the screenplay of this before I saw it, and it's like, "Ooh, Audrey's gonna say I like to lick," you know, the like your mind just kind of goes, what could be done with this scene? This could be a great scene. It could be titillating. It could be sexualized or whatever. And like I said earlier in the actual cast, it's a fucking wet blanket. There's nothing erotic about it. There's nothing enthusiastic about it. I agree completely with Daniel. Sherilyn Fenn did not want to be saying that line to that actor. And I felt like there was zero chemistry between her and Bobby.
I don't know, you could put two hot actors together and sparks may not actually fly.
Chemistry is a real thing, you know.
Yeah.
It just has to be there, you know, and it's not there between the two of them. They're two good-looking human specimens, but you don't want to see them get in bed, you know. It's like that. It would just be like, all right, bathroom break. But anyway, it's interesting we finally get to see Truman's house. It looks like some lonely cabin. I love Cooper and Truman's bromance in this episode, but it's a little gross the way Harry immediately climbs on top of Josie and starts kissing all over her when she clearly looks exhausted and there's even a wound on her forehead.
Yeah, see, that's what I was saying.
Yeah, we touched on this earlier. She looks like somebody smacked her in the head with a baseball bat or something, you know, maybe Catherine beamed or whatever. But you don't know where she's been, how long she's been out, and she comes in and you love her, but instead of going, "Hey, you just walked 5 miles through the woods. You're cold and dehydrated. Let me like get some fluids inside you, get you like some warm tea and a hot bath, and then put you to bed and then talk to you in the morning about what's going on." Now Harry jumps to sex, and it's just like, well, the preamble to it at any rate. So it's kind of like, ugh, that is a little bit icky. But you know, I never really thought about Harry's house, and I hadn't really. I think that's the only time you see it. And nobody else, like you and I, have never talked about it. And no one else we've shown Twin Peaks or that we know who's watched Twin Peaks has brought it up except for Daniel. And it's a good point. He lives like this kind of Spartan existence,
I
you
doubt he
know?
spends much time there.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, he's usually just watching birds and eating donuts and telling Hawk to do the real police work in town. But Major Briggs's abduction at the end is another example of what I was getting at with the Tremont slash Chalfonts. These entities are interdimensional and have powers to manipulate time and space. Who is the cloaked figure standing in the light? Now, we talked about the cloaked figure, and you know, we're kicking around tentatively the idea it could be Windom Earl. Or
yeah,
it,
but I know I'm reaching for that. So
we'll just go with Voltron.
Yes.
Voltron is the most likely candidate. No, but seriously, your guess is as good as mine, man. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't feel like this was followed up on. I don't feel like but it is kind of interesting to bring up the fact that these inhabiting spirits are interdimensional. So it doesn't necessarily have to be aliens. He could have been taken to the White Lodge or the Black Lodge, or I think he does describe
the White Lodge to Bobby.
Yeah. He describes the White Lodge to Bobby, but I think he describes his experiences after this abduction to somebody, right? I don't know who, but
Cooper probably.
Yeah.
I remember Brian he Cooper. Comes home finally. I remember that scene when he comes home. His wife is sitting in the living room. I think Bobby's there too. I'm actually going to be watching a lot of these episodes this week, so try to get a little ahead.
And one last thing I wanted to mention is Joel actually had a follow-up letter about episode 17 feedback, and he's talking a little bit about the Black Lodge and the Red Room, and he says how the Red Room appears briefly in a montage of different locations, but the Black Lodge is mostly a black and white version of the Great Northern and a Pittsburgh dentist's office, if he recalls correctly, which is interesting. It's funny to consider that all the fan discussion of the Black Lodge and what it means are basically a result of Lynch's last-minute decision to bring back the Red Room for the first time since season one and those other characters in the finale in Fire Walk With Me. It's something like a 35-hour saga, including the film and the whole series, but all the lodge imagery is concentrated in the final 3 hours, especially when you consider that our early glimpses of all these characters slash places came at a time when the Black-White Lodge hadn't even been conceived yet. Anyway, if these aspects intrigue you, I'd recommend jumping ahead to episodes 15 and 17 of my video series, Cooper's Story and the Twin Peaks Mythology, respectively. And he has a link on this, on the site we can put up to...
Which I've put up a link for his...
Oh, okay, you've already put it up? Okay.
I recommend one. This is really cool. Joel, I'm so glad that you're writing to us much, you know, and listening to us. I love podcasting because it allows us to interact with people who love things so much that they take the time to create things like you've created. And I recommend that everybody either go to our Twitter, or go to our Facebook page and click on that link and check out what Joel has created. I've started watching it, and I plan to finish it this week.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I had written Daniel, and he wrote me back, but it was he had talked about I had told him that, you know, what I had said earlier about us watching Twin Peaks, how you got me into Fire Walk With Me and everything, and he says, yeah, I can only – this is Daniel now. He says, yeah, I can only imagine how little sense Fire Walk With Me must have made to you without having seen the series first. Yes, yes, that's very true. I'm lucky in that the first time I watched Twin Peaks was in 2007 when I was 17, and it was on Netflix. Talk about the spoiled generation. The only thing I knew was an article that I had read that I can't find anymore about the most unconventional serial killers on TV shows, and they had Bob on the list with the story about that mirror that accidentally caught his reflection, but they didn't say he was a spirit or mention that Leland, so that remained unspoiled. And then on TV Tropes... which I don't know if that's a website or what, but it's just...
I follow it on Facebook.
Oh, it is a website? Mm-hmm. Our Facebook site? Twin Peaks is described as perhaps the strangest show ever to air on television and is given some credit for inspiration to The X-Files, with Agent Cooper being the Agent Mulder before there was one. Huh. That's all I knew. I loved The Strange, so I had to check it out. I thought Bob was a crazed drifter with perhaps Freddy Krueger powers to enter people's dreams until episode 13 when Mike revealed inhabiting spirits. Ironically, Bob was my red herring. Look forward to the discussion at the lodge. And that's all we got for feedback.
Thanks again, Daniel and Joel.
You guys keep writing in. We love to get your letters. We love to read them. We love to read them on the air and discuss them and everything. And this is the, this is really the part of Twin Peaks where we need the most listener discussion and feedback, because
I feel like there are professors and where there's students.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That's a good way to put it. You guys listen to us, but I mean, I feel like I'm going to school anytime I read these letters because I learn something every single time. I'm just I'm a podcaster and I'm a television enthusiast to that extent, you know, and We really wanted to cover Twin Peaks because it was the show that we first fell in love with, a TV show. Because I was pretty derisive of TV before
We
Twin
both
Peaks.
were.
Yeah, we both were.
Well, we both were de still derisive even after Twin Peaks because
True.
we thought that that was the only good television show, and we were like that for years.
We were, but to be fair to us, by the time Twin Peaks ended, between the ending of Twin Peaks and the beginning of the next truly great show that we were really, really in love with was probably
Farscape.
Farscape was well over 10 years. So, I mean, that intervening decade was kind of worthy of our derision in TV land. There was a few things that stood out here and there. X-Files is good,
Yeah, but I didn't, I also hardly ever had a TV hooked up to, so I
I
saw a
didn't either. I just had
couple of
VHS. Yeah.
X-Files and I didn't really watch that consistently. I didn't start watching any television show consistently until Farscape, following Twin Peaks and
Yeah, I could say the same thing.
yeah.
And I mean, that was like,
And that was like a freaking wormhole.
yo.
That sucked us in, and we've been watching television constantly since then.
And if you're wondering, Farscape is really high on our list. This may not be of interest to people who listen to Twin Peaks, but just a general interest to people who, are listening to our podcast. If you're wondering why we don't actually podcast on Twin Peaks, I'm sorry, on Farscape, even though it's one of our top favorite shows, if you can imagine how difficult it was to podcast on this particular episode because of the lack of really great stuff that's in it to grab onto. If anyone's ever watched Farscape, if you could imagine trying to podcast on an episode like Jeremiah Crichton from season one, just think about that for a second.
Yeah, our Zan Solo
Oh, yeah.
episodes. Anyway, so yep. If you guys are any of you of Farscape fans, give us a shout out. Say something on Facebook or Twitter or write to us. Anyway, that's it for this podcast. Is there
That's all
anything
we
else
got.
you
No,
want to say?
that's I think we covered it all.
All
Pretty
right.
exhaustive with the with all the points and feedback and everything, but
Doesn't Voltron have like a saying when they join together?
no, I think you're thinking of something else. It might maybe they might, but Voltron, I was never a big I watched Voltron when I was a kid, but
I did too. I wish I could remember.
so anyway, thank you for downloading this podcast once again. Thank you for listening. Keep the feedback coming. Keep the reviews coming if you're so inclined to do. And I'm your host, Steve.
I am your host, Deb.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds. This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.